welcome back to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Power Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, and this week's episode is entitled Under the Wing. Derived from that phrase where you might take someone under your wing. So we're kind of looking at films that center on some kind of element of mentorship or someone coming under someone's wing to learn something new about the world, seeing a new side of things, or at least a struggle in that kind of dynamic. And then what's, I think, particularly interesting when we talk about this, the phrase of under the wing, we kind of talk about the geometry of that, being underneath someone, someone having sort of a natural sense or state of authority that they can act on another person. I think all these films have this kind of through line of imposing some kind of a shadow of law and order, or some kind of shadow of oppression, or some kind of downward pressure from an authority figure or some position of authority. It's interesting that when we talk about films about mentorship, that there is a lot of imagery of sort of like imprisonment and law and the sort of the hegemony of the legal system or broader sort of societal means of maintaining order. And so if we just think about the idea of like taking someone under your wing to begin with, there always is sort of that hidden authority dynamic. If you think about someone like a parent taking their child under their wing, you know, they do have some authority in that, a teacher doing the same thing, or if you're being trained in a job. But in all those scenarios, it's also that, you know, by doing so, it's not simply just like being imprisoned in a jail, but the whole point of it is to allow that person to individuate, to learn more, to be given more knowledge or more tools and resources about how to live a more liberated life. So it's kind of this like temporary form of oppression or some temporary form of manipulation with the view that in the long term that person will be more free, more empowered and that sort of thing. So it's an interesting dynamic, and trying to tease out the interesting nuances of that, it's going to be hopefully quite enjoyable for you, dear listener. But the first one we're going to talk about is Hal Ashby's 1973 film, The Last Detail. We're then going to move on to a Australian film, Nadia Tass's film, 1986, Malcolm. And then we're going to finish off with a film that we've been very excited to talk about on the show. Has been requested for a very long time. It's finally come out here in London, and it is Alexander Payne, who fans of the show, and I'm a huge fan of Mr. Payne, his new film, The Holdovers. But let's kick things off now with Hal Ashby's The Last Detail. So basically, we've got Jack Nicholson, who plays this character, Badusky, and he's like a Navy guy, and he's palled up with Otis Young's character, who they call Muir, and these are two guys in the Navy, and they're basically being tasked to take this young Navy guy, played by Randy Quaid, his name is Meadows, off to Navy jail, basically, because he stole some charity money from some chief Navy guy's wife's charity box, basically. But he's this kind of plump little impressionable young fellow that hasn't really seen much of the world, and these two sort of old hands basically in taking him across to the Navy jail kind of show him a good time along the way. So they sort of take him under their wing, so to speak, and then sort of show him like, what, you know, all the spoils of being an adult before he's imprisoned. So there's this ironic, I think the thing I kind of want to flesh out in context of talking about this film is this kind of ironic simultaneous presence of liberation and imprisonment. We kind of see this interwoven throughout the film, where these two supposedly opposing forces are kind of simultaneously present at all moments. So we see it particularly in the dynamic between Badusky and Mule, Nicholson's character and Otis Young's character, where Badusky is a bit more of a party, Jack Nicholson is more of a party guy, keen on sinking beers and chatting with girls and having a good time and taking their time on the way they got there. And Mule is a bit more of a traditional rule follower who doesn't really have the luxury of bending the rules. I think there's sort of a subtextual element of him being African-American as well, kind of plays into like, well, he doesn't have the luxury of kind of pushing the envelope, so to speak, that Jack Nicholson has. And there's a very very Earl McMurphy vibe to Nicholson's character in this film, if you haven't seen it. And it feels like Nicholson sort of had a mortgage on this idea of being the guy that pushes boundaries and tests the limits of law and order at this point. I'm kind of become a universal figure of that. But we also see this simultaneous presence and simultaneous tension, constant tension between liberation and imprisonment in the journey itself. So we have, it is a story of a coming of age where it's kind of this nice, beautiful, fun story of a young guy, you know, having his first beer and hanging out with some mates and meeting girls and this sort of thing. But there's a constant underline or a constant backdrop of the fact that this guy has just come out of Navy training, which is a very orderly and task-oriented thing, and he's on the other side of that, is about to go to the Navy jail as well. So there's this constant underlining there of none of this exists in a vacuum. It's only because he's gone to jail that this is happening to him, and simultaneously he's only gone to jail because he kind of pushed the envelope and what was he was allowed to do in stealing the charity money and everything. And I think also just the fact that these guys are Navy guys as well, and this is sort of commented on by Nicholson's character in the film, is like being a Navy guy kind of also in and of itself embodies this idea of liberation and imprisonment, or liberation and oppression all at once. In the sense, because, you know, you live out on the sea, you're on a boat out in the sea, which is a very archetypal symbol of freedom and openness. But at the same time, there's sailors who are sort of fighting wars under very strict orders. So it's like, you know, even if you watch a Navy ad, that it's even how they structure it, and they're actually interesting. They're on before the movies here. But what the Navy is all about is kind of like celebrating it. And sort of these ads are about celebrating, oh, you know, going around the world, doing all these different things, jumping off boats, swimming in the water. But it's like the whole backdrop of that is that because you also have to risk your life and obey pretty strict orders to keep the country safe. Like, it's not a super fun time. Like going to a music festival or something like that. And it also sort of explains why Mule and Badusky are conflicted about the job in the first place, because on one hand it is work and they have duties to maintain, but at the same time they're not going to be, when they're taking Meadows off to this prison, they're not under anyone's thumb. They're kind of their own bosses for a couple of days, and they get given an allowance of money to spend. And there's a lot of eating in the film, a lot of drinking in the film. Like, it's very much, I can see why you'd be conflicted about the detail itself, because which I didn't realize is a term in that for the job they're doing, detail. Then in and of itself, it's sort of a self-conflicting idea. Like, it sounds like a fun thing. It's a bit like going on an excursion at school. It's like, oh, it's going to be a great adventure, but we are still at school as well. And I think sort of if we want to sort of strip back sort of the more literal aspects of this film and kind of get to the bare bones of what I think this film is kind of symbolic of on a deeper level. And I think keeping in mind as well, it's a 1970s Hal Ashby comedy or a dramatic comedy. And what I love about 70s comedies, not all of them obviously, but so many of them are willing to sort of turn into the existential things. Think about like Harold and Maude as well does this, but even Woody Allen's films like Annie Hall, obviously, things like that, they're not afraid to turn into the existential. And I think there is a way that you can read this film that it can serve as a pretty apt symbol for mortality itself, in that we kind of have this dormant life where we're not in existence. We, you know, so we our spirit doesn't really manifest in the physical world, and suddenly we're born into this youthful body where we have this very lively life and all of these great and wonderful opportunities to enjoy the fruits of life. But that's only because there's a backdrop of death, and the only urgency we have to enjoy our lives while we're here, while we're young, is because we know we're not going to be here forever, and so we have to do it now. And there is a sort of an awkward sort of tragicomedy kind of element to life itself, where the beauty of it and the fun of it is only assured through the fact that we can't have it for the rest of eternity. And that's that's the deepest, darkest prison of them all, death. So when we're talking about these concepts like liberation and death and imprisonment, I think it's interesting that we've kind of slightly moved out of this question of, you know, about like actual law and order and jail and that sort of thing, kind of moving into the abstract. What are we actually talking about then when we're talking about liberation and imprisonment, right? Is liberation and dementia, is liberation and imprisonment, are these simply just ideas on a single one-dimensional continuum? Is there just one plane where on one hand we have imprisonment, on one hand we have liberation? You know, if we're under the control of laws, what laws are we under the control of? Or better put, which laws are we under the control of? But before we move on to the next film for today's discussion, just remind you are listening to Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the remainder of this half hour. And be sure to jump onto our website to consider sponsoring the show. subscribing to the station, all that would be very much appreciated. And also stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on the People Powered Radio Station. But moving on now to Malcolm, directed by Nadia Tass. And this one stars Colin Friels from 1986. And basically, if you haven't seen the film, I mean, I don't think this film would come out today because it's ostensibly kind of a film that's rooted in how funny is it this guy is a little bit, what we might say, on the spectrum these days. Almost in a sort of stereotypical sense in that he's very obsessed with trams, and specifically trams and not trains, because he's from Melbourne. And he's in and around his house. He's got all these little whiz-bang gizmos and little mechanical objects and things which he uses to feed his cockatoo and move things around his house. And he's like very obsessed with little mechanical things and that sort of thing. And so we could say, just to begin with, this is a film, at least in the context of today's conversation, how we can look at it. I think it's a film about how one can wield certain laws in order to overcome, or in order to contravene, in a sort of a liberating sense, other laws. So there are different dimensions of laws, and while we can be under the thumb or somehow influenced or suffocated by one sort of dimension of rules and laws, there can be some other dimension of rules and laws that we can use to not only feel more liberated in that dimension, but also import that into the supposed imprisoning dimension that we find ourselves in to begin with. So he is a master of engineering, and in a sense we could say he's sort of a master of the laws of physics or the laws of thermodynamics. He's certainly very, and we can understand this when we think about people, you know, if any kind of savant in any kind of arena, feeling, you know, looking them in full flight and feeling that they're completely unrestrained, something that they're completely not held back by anything, that there's a sort of limitless potential in that particular domain. But then because he's a little bit socially awkward, he is also equally confined within the laws of society. We can see that literally in that when he uses, he makes this like model tram thing at the very beginning of the film, and he's caught and gets in big trouble for doing that. And we see him use his little motor car, little remote control car to get some milk, and he doesn't pay for it. So we're seeing this tension between his mastering of one set of laws and the tension between that mastering with the tension of, you know, the laws of society at large. And we could say that on the whole, this sort of sense of social awkwardness sort of symbolizes the suffocation he feels at the hand of societal norms or society in general, which is, and when I said before, like, that this is a film that I don't think we've made today, I think this is why a film like this probably almost should be made today in a tasteful way, because I think it like we ought to make a film like this still today, because even though it might not be specifically about, you know, specifically someone that is on the spectrum, so to speak, we all experience a sense of being suffocated by society, societal norms. And this is what we could say is an archetypal depiction of that, where someone does have an obsessive respect or a obsessive connection with one thing that is the only sort of realm in which they can feel free, and that the larger society is mostly suffocating. It's something I think we've all experienced at different parts of our life, some more constantly than others. But then because he's struggling with cash, he has to let this guy come in and rent one of his rooms in his house. And this bloke, Frank, who is he's a self-proclaimed crim in the film, played by John Hargreaves, he comes into this house to rent it. And I don't need to say the sort of the symbolic significance of that. We've talked about this a lot on the show, where we have someone entering the house. It's often very symbolic, serves as a very neat and tidy symbol for a certain aspect of the psyche, you know, entering or penetrating the psyche. So the house is very often symbolic of one's own sense of self, and that this new force, this new aspect of one's identity is now coming in, and they're now having to reconcile and deal with that. And so in terms of Frank's characterization, I mean, because he's a criminal, he's sort of innately impervious or innately adept at overcoming laws, right? Specifically the laws of society, i.e. like literal laws. And it's sort of through Frank taking Malcolm under his wing. And it's interesting, in their relationship, there's a bit of push and pull, but there's a kind of like a natural sense of authority that Frank takes, particularly, you know, when they're going to the toilet or urinal and that sort of thing. And it's really funny. In all three of these films, we have the exact same joke made by one man to another about asking him if he's a virgin. And whether, like, there seems to be a thing in the masculine mind that is sort of is the trigger for enacting a kind of under the wing dynamic. But Frank kind of takes Malcolm under his wing, realizing that he's going to be helpful in his criminal endeavors, because Malcolm understands how to use mechanics and all that sort of thing. So it's kind of through Frank taking Malcolm under his wing, and that sort of this synergy that takes place, it's kind of through that synergy that Malcolm reaches his sense of individuation. So it's sort of like by Malcolm, who is mechanically minded, integrating someone who is sort of ignorant or impervious to the laws of society, that is how he's ultimately able to individuate himself. And we see this in sort of the final set pieces of the film in a more of a literal sense. And it's funny because the film appropriates, I don't want to give it away in case you go away and see it, but the film appropriates, because you know, we're talking about the idea of liberating oneself from like a hegemonic legal system or a hegemonic system of rules. It's not something that we necessarily, it's not something that, like, for example, in The Last Detail, you know, we sympathize with Meadows even though he's a criminal in that world. And in Malcolm, we sympathize with these characters even though they're criminals in the specific world they find themselves in. And the film actually uses a very iconic Australian image, but it's been appropriated to a 1980s or a techie or 1980s tech or 1980s mechanical style. There's a 1980s appropriation of this, or corporate appropriation of this famous image we all know. If you've seen the film, you know what I'm talking about. Which again lifts up this idea of at some point we have to liberate ourselves from societal constraints. On some level, we can't just let the world stamp all over us. We have to wield the rules and wield the expertise and the mastering, the ways in which we're masterful need to be wielded to overcome the societal norms that suffocate us. And so I guess we could say in the case of Malcolm that he is through his mastering of physical laws that he's able to liberate himself from the constraints of society. And I think, you know, if we can think about that kind of in the real world as well, like if you compare like maybe like a physical prisoner with like a prisoner of society, you know, like hypothetically a physical prisoner could liberate their mind within the prison cell by reading books. So if you think about someone like Nelson Mandela was able to liberate a nation from within a prison cell. And equally, you can have a person that is literally free in the sense that they have a job and they, you know, work around society, but they are depressed. They have no sort of growth mindset about making their life better, and they go home depressed every day because they have no meaning or no purpose in their life. They don't go read books or write inspirational books. They are, in a sense, an emotional prison. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's always another sort of dimension, another dimension of rules that if we can master it, if we can wield it, the sense of imprisonment we feel in the original dimension is something that we can overcome, perhaps. So on one hand, it sort of seems that we're like this doom to this constant push me, pull you, constant tension between imprisonment, which is and liberty, in the sense that like it's almost like they're in proportion to one another. The more we feel imprisoned, the more we're liberated. The more we're liberated, the more we feel imprisoned, etc., etc. We've got to sort of get that vibe from The Last Detail, where liberation is only done because realized because of the threat of imprisonment. But then in Malcolm, we kind of talk about this idea that we kind of readjusted our concept of what imprisons us, and we start to take on new views and wield new different kinds of laws, new different kinds of rules from different dimensions in order to progress our lives in that sort of first dimension, that first place. So is there a way that we can kind of maybe think about things in a little bit more of a progressive way, that we can sort of look forward in our lives with a little bit more clarity and not be in this mess of not knowing, you know, how to get out of this jungle of imprisonment and liberation in these two colliding concepts? Well, the third and final film we're going to talk about today is Alexander Payne's film from, like, technically 2023, The Holdovers. And basically it stars Paul Giamatti and new up-and-comer actor. He's doing all the rounds, and not so much in the award season, but on the socials. Dominic Sessa, who plays Angus, and wait, that's the sorry, I've got the IMDb here. I just want to make sure I've got the right cast member. But it is Sessa's the guy. But basically, if you haven't seen the film, it's about Paul Giamatti is a very crusty, grumpy, and I love Paul Giamatti. Like, I love Sideways. This is a great performance from him. I just laughed so much in this movie. But he's holding over, which is to say that he's looking after the kids that are staying over during Christmas. And Big Dom is one of the characters that's holding over as well. And I want to talk about this film in at least in the context of today's conversation about how imprisonment, or perhaps we could even say self-imprisonment, is not necessarily at odds with liberation, but is actually can be a means of liberation. So in this sense, the prison in question is this old hoity-toity private school. It's not a literal prison, but they are stuck there over the Christmas break. And if we also think about sort of the background of all this, not only is it, you know, not only are they imprisoned in this physical sort of space, but they're also alienated from a sense of family and a sense of community and solidarity, which is emphasized by the fact that it's happening over Christmas. So they're being rejected by family during the most family-oriented time. It's meant to be an emotionally nourishing time. And the fact that is what that period of time is for makes it all the more cold, all the more horrible that they aren't, being invited to their family homes during that time, and the sort of the snow and the winteriness of the film further emphasizes and highlights that. But, you know, as it's actually joked about in the film, through that kind of cold, harsh time, that's kind of the best, you know, the best springboard for us to develop ourselves, so to speak. I think even as much as I love the film, you can sort of predict the fact that it is going to be through this sort of intense undertaking of sort of being locked down together. I suppose it's really a COVID movie if you think about it. Sorry if other people have said that and that comes across as derivative. I didn't think about it until now. But of course, through this intense sort of lockdown together, these characters learn more about themselves and find solace in realizing that their respective mortal enemy, which is each other, is similarly forcing the same existential dread and identity crises that they are. So even though they feel imprisoned, even though they feel like they can't get away from each other, being imprisoned together, being forced to talk to each other, being forced to hear more about each other, actually helps them learn more about themselves, and they leave and they come at the other end of this endeavor much more individuated, much more confident, much more sure of who they are and who they want to be and what they want to do. So in this sense, we kind of we can look at it as, you know, find solace in find camaraderie in your enemy. Look past the little oddities and the little superficial things that you might not like in a person straight away. Try and find a friend in your enemy. And we could put it that way, but I think that the other way to look at this, or another way to look at it that I prefer, is that it's a conversation between one person, between two sides of the same person. Much like how we talk about a lot on this show about films like Donnie Darko or Interstellar or Tenet or Mr. Nobody, where we have a relationship or a connection between the present self and the future self. Where Angus, the character of Angus, is the present self, and Paul Giamatti's character is his future self. And we're talking about sort of viewing our lives as if we're in direct relationship, in direct connection with the person we one day will be, and informing them and talking to them and listening to them, especially if we're the young one talking to the older one, and if we're the older one, you know, speaking to the younger one in ways that they'll understand, listening to the echoes of the ghosts of our future, so to speak. That's kind of the turn of phrase we talked about when we talked about Interstellar many, many months ago. That in that direct relationship with one another, we can learn about who we should be and realize the trajectory that we're on and how we can, you know, how we can improve that and make a better life for ourselves in that sense. And I think it's really interesting in talking about this generational gap between them, because One of the best scenes in the film is when they go to Boston and they go to this museum. And I shouldn't say best scene because it's just a film that I agree. It's just a scene that I agree with. I don't think that's what movies are for. You're meant to be challenged. But I did on a very indulgent level. There's a scene where they go to a museum and Paul Giamatti is basically saying to Angus that, you know, everything that you see in this room, you know, all the, they're in this ancient Greece classics room. It's like everything in this room that you see is sort of in direct relationship with all the problems of your life today. And he says that, you know, we seem to have this idea that that people in the past didn't have the same problems or didn't have the same revolutionary zeal. Like they didn't have the same sort of thirst for progress and thirst to throw things and change things around. But if you look here, you can see all the ways that artists from the past revolutionized and reimagined the future of the world, which is what we're living in now. And I think that's such an important point to make about the current, because we're so ignorant, I think, for the most part, about people of the past, to think that they were so backwards and stupid and they had no idea what was going on, like, ha, 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 they didn't know how to use a computer. But to think that we've gotten to where we are through all the innovations of the past, we have to give more credit. I think there's even scientific evidence to say that, like, the past versions of Homo sapiens were, like, had bigger brains than we do now, and they've shrunk because we don't need them as much or something like that. But we need to have a relationship with our past selves, where we not that we talk to them because they've already come past us, but we can really acknowledge the direct relationship we have through the different generations and not see ourselves as different things, as different entities, but rather a single string, a single chain of humanity that is in direct relationship with itself, and that we need to have that constant dialogue, that constant stream of communication between generations, even if it does seem oppressive to some degree. It's something that's so important, and if we break that chain, we're doomed to make the same mistakes of the past and not improve our own future selves. But let's try and tie things a little bit better to at the end here. So when we're talking about The Last of Tao, we kind of talk about this idea that it kind of seems like the threat of imprisonment or at least the beauty of liberation is kind of polluted by this constant threat of imprisonment. That these things only happen together. Pure liberation almost doesn't exist. It's like liberation is constantly inextricably connected with imprisonment. But when we talk about Malcolm, we kind of acknowledge that there are multiple dimensions to our lives, multiple dimensions of rules that one must follow, rules and norms and ideas that people feel they need to follow. It's not simply a single continuum of liberation on one end and imprisonment on the other hand, in a physical sense. There's all these different dimensions of rules and the ways in which they can both be hindrances and opportunities. So we've got societal rules, we've got scientific rules, we've got physical rules, we've got metaphysical or religious rules or philosophical rules, whatever your persuasion might be, or spiritual rules. And it sort of seems that we can kind of liberate ourselves from an imprisoning dimension. And it almost feels like we can totally escape a sense of imprisonment or an imprisoning dimension if we get good enough at wielding the rules, wielding the laws from another dimension of life. So perhaps the best answer is not so much that imprisonment can never be, we can never escape from a sense of imprisonment, but perhaps what's more important is that we see that imprisonment and being locked down with something or someone that feels imprisoning can actually be our means of liberation. It's through that hard work that we might feel in a state of imprisonment that actually we're guaranteed a sense of liberation. Because after all, could it not be that the pressure we feel under someone's wing is not the very thing that helps us grow our own set? Well, that's all we've got time for this week here on Sacred Cinema, recorded here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Thanks again, as always, for tuning in, and please stay tuned for more quality radio programming. If you're listening live, if you're listening online, be sure to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show, and feel free to get in touch with me. You can email me at contact@jimmyburnasconi.com. But until next week, have a good one, and we'll see you again then. Cheers.